This is Dave Itzkoff, culture reporter for the New York Times. One of the great pleasures of this job over the past 7 years has been getting to write about Mad Men, the hit AMC period drama about the advertising executive Don Draper and his colleagues and cohorts at a fictional 1960s New York agency. Since its debut in 2007, Mad Men has become one of television's most influential and imitated shows, as well as the winner of 4 consecutive Emmy Awards for Outstanding Dramatic Series. Credit for that success is due to many people, not least of them Matthew Weiner, who is the creator of Mad Men and has been its showrunner from the very beginning to the very end, which, sadly, is coming on May 17th. That's when Mad Men will broadcast its final episode, and after 7 groundbreaking seasons, the story of Don Draper will reach its conclusion. Or will it? Here with me to talk about Mad Men is Matthew Weiner. Matt, thanks very much for joining me.
Thank you, David. It's great to be here.
Thanks.
Always nice to talk to you.
I appreciate that. So, I mean, it was announced more than 4 years ago now that this current 7th season of the show was going to be the last season
right.
of Mad Men. Have you been thinking for that long about how you would wrap up the series?
No, I'm a creature of habit, which basically means not having any habits. It was one of the reasons I fought so hard to not have the running time cut and to not get rid of the cast. It's like I was like, we've gotten this far. We figured out how to do the show. I don't want to change that. What I really didn't want to change when I found out there was going to be 36, then 37, which I did fight for, and more episodes, was I didn't want to change pulling out all the stops on every season. You tell the story. You go for broke. You use everything you have in the story. You do a finale that could be the end of the show every season. We came back after that with season 5, Don and Megan's relationship. It ends with You Only Live Twice, with him really calling his marriage quits on some level and going in a bar for Are You Alone? Okay, then we start the next season, season 6, in Hawaii with this idea that something is amiss. And what it is that Don is – his childhood is sitting in his lap. He is back where he was in a way. You know, we find out he's having an affair with his neighbor. He says, I don't want to do this anymore. And we work that all the way through this political year of 1968, where the culture's id and Don's id seem to be on the same track and the world's id. And then we work our way to this reaction, this conservative reaction, in which Don actually has a breakthrough and takes Sally after destroying her innocence in an act of contrition or whatever, of honesty or of growth, to show where he grew up. So I didn't know that I was going to do that story the season before that. I knew what year it was going to be. And then when you start this last season, and it is one season, I knew there would be a time jump in it, and I kind of liked that it was easier for me to do with that time period in between it. But, you know, that wasn't up to me. And so now I have these 2 7-episode seasons that are – for basically the way everybody else is doing TV right now, where we're kind of the last people to be doing a 13-episode season. Everyone else does 10, or, you know, Downton Abbey does 7, True Detective is 8. That's kind of what it is, except for The Good Wife. God bless them. And my hat's off to them, because I worked in network TV. And let me tell you, when you're breaking those last 9 episodes, they deserve extra credit for right. the degree of difficulty. Seriously, it's just like, yeah. you know, but you do have a different rule about repetition than you can have on a show like this.
Right.
So now, without being defensive, which is very hard, because it always feels like that, the most predictable thing about Mad Men at this point is the way the public has reacted to episode 2 of every single season. And I think that my desire to tell a new story is always disappointing to them. And they're some of my favorite episodes. I can name them, you know. And I'm always like on the defense about this. I'm like, Flight 1, the very first 2nd episode, when all of a sudden they're paying attention to Betty Draper and they're like, who is this? Where's Pete? What's going on?
So you had to basically put yourself through that twice in the course of the
exactly.
2 halves of season 7.
Exactly.
So you did pick up, you feel like, on maybe some restlessness that people want to see, at least in these last 7 episodes, they wanted to see some clear sense of moving to something clearly
conclusive. Let's talk about what people means. When I took history, the first serious history class I took, and you can tell that I'm interested in that,
mm-hmm.
I got placed into a AP European history class in 10th grade, even though all my other grades were terrible because I had showed promise in history. And I had this wonderful teacher, Dr. Johnson, who basically said, whenever you hear the word people, you are hearing baloney. That is a political term. It doesn't refer to anybody. It's used by individuals who control people or want to control people, and it doesn't really reflect anything. People are unpredictable. Yeah. They are always divided. They are individuals. So now I'm sort of looking at, like, what is the difference between a bunch of individuals who have come to the show to write about it online, some of whom have never liked it, some of whom have never watched it before, who are going to get hits and sort of be in the business of covering the show. God bless them. I love people covering the show, good and bad. I do believe that. Okay. I really do. It's the Howard Stern thing, you know, of like someone who loves Howard Stern listens an hour, someone who hates Howard Stern listens 2 hours. I'm very, very much very, very mercenary about that. I love that there's a conversation. Now, when I refer to people that I know that are watching the show or, you know, sending me emails, and they don't all the time, are really, really enjoying the show, but they are a little bit mystified about where it's going and what's going on. And I got to tell you, that's my job.
Sure.
That is my job. I'm not doing, you know, how do you keep a moron in suspense? I'm not playing that game. I have a story, and the story starts on page one, not on page 50. I could tell you the Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs and start with her in the glass coffin with the prince coming up and just tell you, oh, she got poisoned, the witch was after her, blah, blah, blah. So now the guy's coming, he's going to kiss her and she's going to wake up. Right. And I sort of feel that there's this insinuation that there's not enough meat on the carcass. And all I can tell you, you know, or what is a good Mad Men episode or how it's going to be done, all of these things – failure to meet the expectations of what is a typical Mad Men episode to me is a tremendous success, because I don't believe there is such a thing. We never think that way.
Sure.
Anything that smacks of an episode that you've seen before, we're either going to play with, we're either luring you in, or I will throw it out.
Sure.
If you actually take each episode seriously, and I'm not accusing people of not taking them seriously enough. I can't tell you how to watch the show. And it's got to be different watching it now, because there's also this other emotion. And by the way, I watch TV. Sure. I know the emotion of losing your show.
Yeah.
It clouds your experience. It really does. This is not an action show, but you know, when you see Peggy with those young girls and Pete pulls her in to tell her and they sit on that couch, that is deliberately an echo of, you know, I don't know what the episode is, but where Pete tells the hunting story.
Right.
You know, I could have done the exact same scene. I could have, like, given the little Easter egg and the wink to the audience. Right. I'm not doing it.
Yeah.
I'm not doing it. I'm trying to convey what's going on in these people's lives. And the meta part of it is that it's actually ending. But it is ending. And I tried – with the writing staff, we tried to channel all of our emotions about saying goodbye. I think when people are watching the show who don't have to do more than experience the show – and talk to their friends about it, who don't have to put up a report in 15 minutes and write a book report where all the characters' names are wrong and things are referenced and all this other stuff, and it gets a letter grade and all this other. If you don't have to do that, if you're not in the business of dissecting the show, you're having a very interesting experience with what feel, hopefully, more than ever like real people.
Yeah.
And that, to me, you know, is what we were after.
As somebody who watches television, worked amply in television even before you came to Mad Men.
Sure.
I mean, what do you think should be the function of a good series finale? Is it, do you have an obligation to give each character a kind of final moment and a kind of memorable exit?
You're in the entertainment business. You have an obligation to give a big finish. It's been 92 hours. There'll be 92 hours. I hate to say it. I don't really feel like I owe anybody anything. I've been lucky to have them invite us into their home, but we have held up our end of the bargain so far. We really have. And we've made such painstaking effort to surprise and delight and move people. You have to commit to the fact that you're never going to see the same show. So there is no typical thing. This is why you end a show, because the machinery that tells the story, you don't want to start to see the gears and pulleys and like, oh, you start doing a story and then you realize you've done it. So you say, I'm going to turn it on its head, and then it becomes binary. You want an organic journey if you've created real people. Did I know when I started the show, when I wrote the pilot, that Joan, in that first conversation with Peggy, that Joan would be a single mother, working woman? No. That's all little decisions, just like life, all along the way. Did we know that Dom was going to get remarried if we went on long enough? Probably. It fits his character that he would have a bunch of wives. It fits his character that he might be so terrified of getting caught at the beginning, and then as he ages, start to become more relaxed. But I am a good 5 years ahead of Don, right? And so I've sort of tried to play with what was psychologically going on with me and where my childhood fit into my life and where how success affected me and how it affected all of us. And let's not leave out these two companies that I started with, Lionsgate and AMC, both of which were as mired in mediocrity and financial problems when we started as Sterling Cooper was. And so now we have these two giant publicly traded companies with you know, high stock prices, and they're competitors to all the people that they were admired. So, you know, are you waiting for the other shoe to drop? What's the story? I felt that this season, this piece of this season, that moment of Cooper dying when they got that windfall, that's what I'm writing about. That's what I'm interested in. Your material needs have been met. What else is there?
Right.
Very profound question. That's okay. What Diana is about. I mean, what does that man need?
In a way, I feel like you have a greater challenge even than shows like Breaking Bad or Justified in terms of how those shows ended with very well-executed finales, I thought. But in some ways, the nature of those shows sort of dictated what the finale should be.
If you do a legal show, I love The Practice. I love that show. And Law and Order, they sort of mixed it up also. But when you do a legal show, there's a court case at the end and there's a verdict. And they could win or they could lose. Both are dramatic. They could win sometimes when they don't want to win because they're defending somebody that they don't respect or they know something. They could lose the one that really matters and say, we'll get them next time. There could be no decision. But you, when that black comes up at the end, that is promised.
Right.
In Agatha Christie, there must be the scene, although she plays with it too, when everybody's taken to the library.
Right.
And all shall be revealed. That's delightful. Sherlock Holmes, right? This is not that kind of show. I made a comment a long time ago when someone says, how does the show end? And it's been thrown in my face a few times recently. Like, you said it was going to be in 2011 or whatever, and Don would be whatever. And I was like, all I was saying is, like, if these are real people, how do you think it ends? You know, which is what I loved about Six Feet Under's ending. It was a formula in a way to start each episode with some random person dying, and they found a million ways to come in the window on this thing.
Right.
At a certain point, it was just like a delight. Like, what are they going to do? Just like the little tag at the end of The Simpsons or something. It's like this is their form.
Right.
And to do that for each of the characters at the end of the show was this beautiful rhyme. And
yes,
he shot it beautifully. It had been about the nature of death and the kind of death people have and what story was in that the whole time. There is something like that, believe it or not, to Mad Men. I'm not saying that's what I'm doing. I'm just saying we have our own thing. There's no formula. I wanted to tell the story, and I had a decision to make, which we can talk about maybe when it's all over, that the audience doesn't enter into. And that decision is what would really happen.
What is real for Mad Men versus what was real for Six Feet Under, what was real for
But do you understand?
Breaking
I'm talking
Bad.
About – no, but there – no. But, what's real for Breaking Bad is you have a genre that asks a question and then you have to answer it, and there's only two answers. He dies or he lives. The end of Breaking Bad, he dies rescuing Jesse, you know, which he's done before, but he doesn't die. He comes back and he kills the neo-Nazis. The other option is for him to get away with it. To consider more options is to basically end up with The Sopranos, right? Christopher did not show up at the end of The Sopranos. Tony did not save him, and you saw the Russian and all that stuff. That's just not the kind of story it was. It never promised that. In terms of people feeling right now that I am not fulfilling a promise or being – I don't know if they feel that way or if they're just anxious that I can't fulfill the promise or whatever – all I can tell you is that we're telling a story. This is the natural conclusion of the story.
Right.
I've really, really broken a lot of rules over the life of the show to make it feel real in terms of people actually getting divorced. And like I said, the only thing that's sort of been preposterous is that somehow these people all stayed together. That is really it.
Right.
Because when you know, when you lose an account, everybody gets fired who's on the account. You know? And so what we're seeing was actual consequences, which is, guess what? That's what's going to happen. Right. There's no way out.
Now, you referenced The Sopranos, and people listening are thoroughly familiar. I'm sure that you were a producer on that series.
Yeah, sure.
Did your experience there working on the conclusion of that series influence how you think about the finale here, in the sense that The Sopranos has arguably the most memorable, certainly the most talked about finale.
It's 10 years later.
And we're still talking about
it.
Did David Chase even sort of take you guys in and say, okay, here's what's going to happen, here's what I'm going to do? Was there discussion of that?
Oh, yeah. We heard about it long before it happened. Once David knew he wasn't going to fire you, he would share that with you pretty early on. I don't think anybody knew that it would be such a experience for people, you know, positive and negative. I think, you know, the show is ending. And I think that's the emotion you're getting a lot of times. You're also getting some people, and I experienced this, who watched the end of The Sopranos who had never seen the show. And they were really angry. They were the angriest people. But like,
well, the lesson is, don't start with the finale of a series, no matter the series.
Yeah. I mean, you know, ending a TV show is not a natural thing to do. Nobody's happy about it. Maybe somebody whose contract is up is happy about it, you know? It's hard to shock people when there's so much anticipation, and people will never be shocked again once it's done. You know, we still have this week-to-week waiting period on this where the shows marinate and people hypothesize, and I love that. I love that. You can't do that on a show that's released all in one day. But each person has their own experience in life, you know? I don't even know what it's going to feel like when it ends. You know, someone tells you what it's like to get married. Is it helpful? Have you ever been here in the paper when someone had their last day? Like retirement, not, I mean, fire.
Oh, sure.
Okay, so do you know what that's like?
Only from the outside.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And it's the same thing with writing it. I kind of am a little annoyed that I feel defensive about it and then I'm put in a defensive position. It goes with the territory.
Sure.
It all goes with the territory. I shouldn't be annoyed about any of it. I can't believe that we did 92, that we were on the air this long. You know, the show business part of it is like hard to fathom.
Sure.
Like what changed in my life and that so many, you know, things exceeded my expectations, you know.
Yeah.
And you really feel grateful when you get to the end of this. That is something that you're almost too nervous to express while you're still making it.
What will you actually do the night that the finale airs? It's going to be a Sunday night, May 17th. Are you going to allow yourself to watch it, or are you going to go into a bunker somewhere and just wait for it to pass?
No, I'm doing the exact opposite of a bunker. We are going to have an event in Los Angeles. Jason Reitman is a fan of the show, and he does this wonderful thing where he takes scripts and recasts them, and they do a live reading. So they're going to do the first season finale, The Wheel, on a stage in Los Angeles at the Ace Hotel. There's an old – I think it's the United Artists movie theater. It's a 2,000-seat movie theater with a new cast reading this episode, which will – I've seen it a couple times. I saw them do Big Lebowski, and I saw them do something else. Maybe It's a Wonderful Life or something. It's always – the contemporary ones are more fun because – you've just seen someone play the role. And then after it, that crowd will watch the finale and the cast is supposed to come. I've invited the crew. We will take up whatever, 200 of those seats in that 1,500, 2,000 seat theater. And then we'll have a party afterwards.
Right. But then you're going to be getting reaction to it immediately.
Yeah, I'm not going to do any press. Oh, physical reaction? I have never had a bad experience showing an episode to a crowd.
Right.
We showed Tomorrowland, which I think to date is probably one of the most controversial episodes of the show. I'm very proud of it. I think it's a really great episode, and I do rank them in my head. But Don not choosing Dr. Fay and spontaneously, impulsively, almost drunkenly, one would say, proposing to Megan was shocking, and people were shocked. I was in a crowd at an event, at a charity event where we were screening that, and everyone was sort of coming up to me and they're like, you know, whatever the facial version of WTF is. they weren't even saying anything because people, anyone who compares it to a soap opera is not hurting my feelings. That is what, you know what I mean?
They know you have an investment
in the people.
They know who to praise and who to blame if when it ends. So, I mean, you're whatever the reaction is.
They weren't blaming me or anything like that. They were just like stunned. I don't court the fist pumps so much. Right. I think they're kind of always accidental.
Right.
Plenty of people have had great, you know, mojoust, whatever. We frequently show the finale in front of a crowd. and make a party out of it. And the premiere, we always have a crowd. And it's always exciting to me. A couple of things that nobody cares about, but it looks great projected. It's the sound work is always done well enough that it holds up. Sure. We have great sound design that you don't always get at on your TV at home. And then there's always a lot of laughs. And I don't know if people laugh as much at home as they sort of realize how silly some of it is.
But you mentioned that you're not going to do any press following the episode.
Now, I'm doing one talk, and I'm sure, you know me, I can't keep my mouth shut. I'm sure at some point, if anybody asks me about it in the future, there will be some conversation. But I don't want to I don't want to be on the defensive. And it's not because I'm anticipating, whatever. I feel like I've already talked too much about the show, quite honestly. And half the time I'm defending it and I'm trying to explain what I meant, and it's kind of like the show should do that. You know, I admire that about David Chase. You know, he's Italian, maybe that's it. I needed to talk about the show because I was not on HBO, and it became apparent right away that it helped sell the show. I did not ask to be out in front of it. I did not ask to answer fan questions or any of those things. There was no Twitter or any of these things when we started. So it really required having a conversation with me. Those inside Mad Men things, none of that was my idea. But it helped people become interested in the show. And I don't mind having a conversation about it. You just don't want to feel like you've failed so terribly if no one understands what you're trying to do. I have not had that yet. But I'm going to have a conversation with a writer friend of mine, A.M. Holmes, at the New York Public Library, and that'll sort of be the decompression of it. I don't anticipate people standing up front with pitchforks and like hot tar or anything like that.
But does that come in any way? I mean, you talked about David Chase. I mean, here he is 10 years later still trying to explain to people in as sort of polite and careful a way as he can what the Sopranos finale was, and people still not totally grasping it for whatever reason. You not want to sort of send yourself down that road where 10 years later you're still going to be telling people this is what the Mad Men finale was?
Hey, if we're talking about the Mad Men finale 10 years from now, I did a great job. I consider that a success. If you do your ending right, it is a great ending. It is not a reflection on the entire TV show, but it is a great ending. It is what it is, you know. Sometimes I want to sit next to you and tell you what it is, but I'm really hoping that it is an experience for people that they don't need decoded. I hope they want to talk to each other about it. I don't really need them to talk to me.
Yeah, I mean, you've actually finished the work on all these episodes.
In October.
Yeah, been done for some time. What was your final day of work at the Mad Men office?
There's so many endings that you stop paying attention to the investment of it. I'm not good at saying goodbye anyway, but I invited a friend of mine from film school. We actually went to college together, but we didn't know each other in college, named Doug Cass, and he's a professor at Elon University. But he shot my documentary when I was in film school, and he's really smart. And he came out to keep me company. And I talked a lot, and it was kind of like watching your grandma move. You know, I was like, hey, remember this? And he's like, no. And Heather was there, my assistant, who I know you've met, who became a writer on the show. There was a couple of PAs who I tried to give employment to anybody I could as late as we could. It was really serious. It was really all emotional things for me, a complete surprise. I took a picture of myself. There's a word for that that also has happened in the last 7 years. I took a picture of myself at that last moment alone in there. I just remember seeing the picture and going like, oh my God, you really can't control how sad you are. And it was just like a surprise. And driving home from the studio, some stuff went into storage, and you know, there's stuff going to a museum. There's so much positive. And there's this thing that happened. But you know, you can see what a fetishist I am and see like, you know, my connection to spaces, and you know, I saved a lot of things. I threw out a lot of stuff. Uh-huh. You know what it is? You save stuff and you anticipate one day you're gonna look at it again. That's why you save it. And that was the day. You know, I'm not going to save every birthday card, but I did save it since season one. Wow. So let's look and see who these names are. We had so many people who've been working on the show the whole time. I didn't realize it. I'd see people that barely knew me, and you know, now I've been with them. They've had three kids, you know.
Did you grab yourself any great piece of Mad Men memorabilia?
There is so much stuff in my office. There's so much stuff in my office anyway. I have so much great Mad Men memorabilia, and it's mostly meaningful to me. Some of it I was like, maybe I'll give these as gifts some point, you know. Claudette, our set decorator, and Ellen Freund, our prop master, and Janie to some degree, they know that I am their audience. Dan Bishop, too. People were giving me sort of the choice stuff, right?
And there's the first refusal. Yeah.
No. They would be like, hey, you know, during the whole show, they're like, hey, remember those pictures I took of, you know, when we were deciding what T-shirt Megan should wear that started all that crap on the internet? Here's the T-shirts. Here's the pictures of the T-shirts. You know, remember when you said you wanted an ashtray from Luchow? Little elements like that. Those were all in my office. And then things people gave me actually. The weird thing is most of it's really old already. So I'm glad I'm like the ninth person on it.
I imagine when you have an experience with a series like Mad Men that's as successful as it is that – you can basically do whatever you want next. So are you giving any thoughts to what your next act is going to be?
I think about it all the time, and I'm actually kind of, you know, I don't talk about it a lot, but I'm working on a couple of things already. I love that people ask me, and at the same time, I hate that I don't have an answer. You know, my career is exactly as long as my oldest son. He was born at my first job. So I've been working for 18 years. I have learned a few things that do not change. What you can do immediately, no matter what, is exactly what you just did. That is really what people are interested in. So every script or idea that comes through, would you like to do Mad Men, you know, in a cookie factory? Would you like to do, you know, and a lot of the stories that came to me during the show, you know, my uncle worked in the insurance company. It's like Mad Men, but it's insurance. And I'm kind of like, hey, that's not as good.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you know, it's Mad Men and it's in publishing, or it's Mad Men and it's in a newspaper. I hope somebody does that show because I would want to watch it. But I don't want to do it. It's not like I have no relationship with the audience. I thought of Mad Men because I was trying to think of a TV show that I really wanted to watch, and I wanted to live in that, and I had something to say about it, something political to say about it, something personal to say about it. It's my parents, all kinds of things. So those ideas are very different. The things that come from your gut about what you would like to – it's not like you're not thinking about an audience. You're not – you don't just do whatever you want. Like, hey, you know what? I've earned the right to, you know – although could I do anything more slow or whatever? You know, it's like I've earned the right to do whatever I want is not the mindset of someone who struggles to work. It's the same thing. You have the same job. There's no writer in the world who's like, oh, you like my last novel? Now I'm going to do whatever I want. Right? I'm going to try and write a novel that you're going to like also. I've gotten a lot of very helpful advice, some of which has been, you know, hey, whatever you do, don't stop working. I'm like, all right, thank you.
Great, yeah.
Thank you. That's too late for that. A lot of people sort of – this is one of these weird things about like friends where they're like, God, you took time off. I always wanted to do that. I just couldn't. But good for you. And right away you're thinking like, oh, should I have not taken time off? No one's been through the experience. Yeah. I feel – refreshed. I feel kind of like at zero. I will never stop feeling humbled. When you take risks like I do, writing-wise, there's always, you know, the precipice there.
Yeah.
So I'm like kind of thinking of like different formats and stories that I want to tell and things that I'm interested in. And it's been kind of exciting, you know. And quite honestly, let's not discount the fact that, and I hope this works for the people who wrote on the show too. I mean, I got to make Mad Men because I worked on The Sopranos. AMC was like, that guy was one of those people, whether he wrote all those episodes or not, whether David Chase rewrote him, anything else like that, he wrote this pilot and he was in that room and he has been exposed to how success works or how you at least try to do something like that. Not everybody who worked at The Sopranos can produce The Sopranos. I know that. But you got a better chance than someone right off the street, good or bad. So I feel a lot of incredibly positive things about people wanting to work with me. And that's exciting.
What about, you know, maybe you can finally write that guest episode of somebody else's show that you've been – you had a good idea for a Big Bang Theory episode?
You know what? I've said it to them before. I would love to be in that Simpsons room. I would love to get a crack at one of those things. I'd love to be rewritten by the Simpsons writers because I know that's what it would be. I did pitch jokes for a long time. There's certain formats that I've always wanted to sort of try that I will try. I don't know. What do you think I should do?
Oh, man. If I had the answer to that.
What would you like?
Whew. Now you're putting me on the spot.
I know. I mean, you could say. I'm not gonna. I can't promise I'm gonna listen.
I don't think that I have the right answer, because if I had told you what to do after The Sopranos, I couldn't have told you that was what made something like Mad Men work. We didn't necessarily know we needed it at the time, and we certainly didn't.
Yeah.
We didn't know that we needed a period drama set in what seemed like a bygone era, and right. on a channel that we were watching for, you know, Westerns and The Godfather.
That's always been my joke. I got to meet Clint Eastwood, and I said, I've always wanted to work with you, but I settled for being on AMC.
How did he take that?
He loved
oh,
it.
Oh, great.
He gets choked. He's getting some checks from them.
Yes.
He has. He's getting some residuals. Not that he needs them, but they're definitely – I like being part of that.
Yeah. Did I sidestep your question effectively?
No. Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where you sort of like, I mean, I definitely would like to work in TV again. There's nothing like it. I don't know if people understand that a series idea is different than a limited series idea. And then on the one hand, you can do a mini series or something, which is, let's say, a very complex movie with multiple characters that's, you know, 10 episodes. But having an idea that has machinery in it that can support 100 stories. That's a very unusual idea. And I knew Mad Men was one. I had an opportunity to turn it into a movie or turn it into a half hour or all these other things. I was always like, let me tell you right now, I know you think this would be a good movie. Finding out that Don Draper's married in the middle of a movie is useless.
Yeah.
It really is. It's a twist, maybe, a small one. Finding out at the end of an episode, when you're supposed to come back and be watching this environment that by nature is not changing.
Right.
That's what we got to play with, yeah. is what people expect on TV. Everybody's friends. Everybody does the right thing. People bail each other out. People anticipate each other's needs. People rescue each other. People care about each other. People know what's going on in each other's lives. People go with each other to do important things in their lives. That's an entertainment construction. I'm not saying entertainment shouldn't provide that for you. It's a wish fulfillment. But I wanted to do something that I felt was much more like my experience of life. And that's not dark or unhappy. It's just – it doesn't work out as perfectly.
Do you have a sense of what even the TV's appetite is right now, or what it wants, in the sense that – for years and years and years, there was really only the one model for drama,
yeah.
which was the 22 episodes a season.
But there were so many different things. You know, when you go into a network like AMC or HBO now, and they have a list of reverse engineering, like rules and stipulations and theories about how they make a successful TV show, you're basically fighting all the stuff that I had to fight when I wrote Mad Men. There's so much money in it, and there's so many venues. It's probably going to take finding the biggest loser in the world to have something new come out. It really is. Who's going to take that risk? TV is, like a lot of entertainment, is derivative. And now there's this kind of, I think, oversimplification of like, oh, I'll make him an unlikable character because that's what people like. It's not like that. You know, David Lynch coming to TV was a very important part of my creative life, and David Chase's, and I know that for a fact. Yeah. So there's innovation going on the one hand, and there's imitation going on the other hand. And I have a weird feeling that the imitation part of it is going to kind of like overload the audience, and that it's going to be hard to be heard. And that something new, which I am always open to as a viewer, is going to have a hard time getting through. And maybe the next wave is going to happen on YouTube or something. You see it. I mean, there's more TV than ever, right?
It's impossible. And I, somebody who joyfully keeps up with as much TV as I can, and I'm maybe right now at that threshold where I'm starting to feel a little bit inundated.
Right.
And not just with mediocrity, but with like a lot of really good stuff that
right.
I never – even in the era when people would say, well, my DVR is full, that never bothered me. But now I have a full DVR plus Netflix plus Hulu.
Well, it's all there.
Yeah.
If it was one episode a week on Netflix, it'd be a different thing.
That would change the experience.
Yeah. You're just like – you know, I just saw the pilot of Daredevil, which Phil Abraham did, and someone is like comes and tells you the entire thing. That's hard. That's intimidating. That's when it starts feeling like homework. I guess it always is for you.
It will not feel like homework to me to watch the Mad Men finale.
Oh, thanks.
I will look forward to that as eagerly as the many others who are wondering what's going to happen and who one way or the other will be expressing their feelings on the internet the moment that it ends. You don't have to engage with that, though. I look forward to it. I'm glad that you could come by today.
Thank
to
you
talk
so much,
about your
David.
Process.
Thank
it's
you
a pleasure
very much.
To see you.
I appreciate it.
Matthew Weiner, thanks for your time today.
Absolutely.